is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It's a day of ceremonies, speeches, and fences. The country is saying farewell to the outgoing president and is about to pause to hear our 46th president take the oath of office. We'll get the latest from downtown D.C. in a moment, but first, Donald Trump has now left the White House. This morning, before setting off to Florida on board Air Force One, he spoke to a small crowd of supporters at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. Here's part of his final farewell as President of the United States.
I wish the new administration great luck and great success. I think they'll have great success. They have the foundation to do something really spectacular. So just a goodbye. We love you. We will be back in some form. And again, I want to just, in leaving, I want to thank our Vice President, Mike Pence, and Karen. I want to thank Congress because we really worked well with Congress, at least certain elements of Congress. But we really did. We've gotten so much done that nobody thought would be possible. But I do want to thank Congress. And I want to thank all of the great people of Washington, D.C., all of the people that we worked with to put this miracle together. So have a good life. We will see you soon. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
President Trump then waved to the crowd and left the stage to the sounds of YMCA by the Village People. The scene and sounds from downtown D.C. look a little different. Let's welcome back Dominique Maria Benessi. She's a reporter at WAMU, our parent station here in D.C. Dominique, where are you right now?
Thanks, Jen. Yeah, I'm on the corner of 7th Street in Indiana. It's about a half a block from Pennsylvania Avenue and right next door to the Navy Memorial. It's one of two designated protest sites for today.
Is anything open? Is it even possible to drive into the area where you are at the moment?
So you can't drive here. You can only really get here on foot. I do see one gentleman here on bike. There's a few places open. There's a sports tavern open here. It looks like maybe at one or two other restaurants that are open for people. And there's a small crowd of people gathered just right next to this 8-foot tall black fence. And this black fence that you can see all over D.C., downtown D.C. today.
Is anyone around who you've been able to talk to? Or does it seem like, for the most part, people have heeded the warnings to stay away?
So Tyrone Turner, our photographer at WAMU, and I have been downtown D.C. since 8 a.m. this morning. It's been very slow. We haven't seen too many people. I saw a handful of protesters. Literally, I think I saw three. And it seems like there's a lot more media down here than anything. And people, it seems like, have just really stayed away and taken Mayor Bowser and Virginia and Maryland governor's advice just to stay home and watch the inauguration from home.
Now, the FBI dropped 12 members of the National Guard from the inauguration security detail. What do we know about why they were removed from their duties?
I'm sorry, Jen, can you repeat that question? I couldn't hear you too well.
Sure. The FBI dropped 12 members of the National Guard from the inauguration security detail. What do we know about why they were removed from their duties?
Right. So there was FBI was doing further background checks into these National Guard members. They believed that these National Guard members could have been linked to far-right extremist groups, and there was suspicion of an insider attack around these few days that have led up to the inauguration, so they were removed from their duties.
Talk a bit more about the steps the city has taken to guard against any further unrest today.
Absolutely. Since last Friday, I believe, these fences have gone up. There is a green perimeter around the city in which you can only walk through, and there's a red perimeter which you have to have probably top secret security clearance to get in. Even members of the media, we are not allowed onto Pennsylvania Avenue or the National Mall today. No one is allowed. They've closed down the entire National Mall. All their memorials are closed down. And they have also closed off metros and bridges into the city. So 13 metro stops around the mall area, and then several bridges coming across from Maryland and Virginia have also been shut down, and all with this idea that they're trying to make sure people stay home and that we're not forming large crowds. And this is also in light of the pandemic, obviously, that we're seeing new strains now in Maryland and other places in the country.
We're talking to WAMU's Dominique Maria Benessi. She's joining us from downtown D.C. on this inauguration day. Dominique, can you give us a sense for just how things feel right now?
Yeah, this is my third inauguration down here in D.C., and this is the quietest I've ever heard it. I remember Trump's inauguration. I was here, and there were people screaming and shouting on the streets already at 9 a.m., either excited or counter-protesting the inauguration. There's just not as much life this morning. There's a lot of security. It feels very different. It feels very tense. But you do see people that, you know, are out and about. There are a few people in, you know, the surrounding neighborhoods that are trying to, you know, go walk their dog, have a regular day, and then go watch the inauguration on TV.
Well, and you bring up an important point there. While D.C. is the seat of our nation's government, it's also home to 700,000 people who, you know, just live and work in the district. Have you gotten a sense for whether people are reassured by such a heavy presence of military personnel, or do they find it a little intimidating?
So I found from some people, they say, you know, increased security does make them feel more secure in the downtown area. However, I've also heard from people up in Deanwood and Ward 7 in D.C., which is northeast D.C., that are saying, you know, I would stay away from downtown right now. I'm worried for my safety. Some people have said they've seen one or two far-right extremists in their neighborhoods, and they say that concerns them. There's a mixed sense of security here. Some people saying, yeah, the military presence makes me feel more secure. Others saying, you know what, I'm going to avoid downtown and try to stay in my home and stay in my neighborhood.
And do we know when things will go back to, and I hesitate to use this word here, but normal?
Yeah, that's a really big question right now. You know, the national state of security for D.C. is supposed to end, I believe, Thursday. But then again, this fencing, it's going to, you know, while it took came down very quickly, we will see how long it takes to get it. It took a long time to get it up. We'll see how long it takes to get it back down. And people are really hoping that, you know, they can go ahead and go back to walking around the National Mall or going back to their jobs in the downtown area without having to pass through security checkpoints. But again, you know, it might end Thursday. We really don't know.
So I want you to describe for people who are going to be watching the inauguration from home, describe the huge number of small flags we're seeing for Inauguration Day and what they represent.
Right. So there are flags on the National Mall. And these are 400,000. So 400,000 is the number we've reached in the number of COVID-19 cases here in the United States. And they last night there was a ceremony remembering those who have died from this pandemic. And those are the flags you'll see along the National Mall. However, those who are, you know, back a ways, you won't be able to see those flags because, you know, you can't actually get to the National Mall today. But on TV, you should be able to see them.
And what is the schedule for the rest of the day?
So at 11 o'clock, ceremony should be starting around 11:15. Biden and Harris will arrive at the Capitol building. They've previously had gone to St. Matthew's Cathedral in downtown D.C. For Mass, then over to the Capitol building for the swearing in. We should be hearing Lady Gaga sing the national anthem. And then from there, they will be parading down Pennsylvania Avenue. There have been some bans and a pass and review being done by Biden of the military. There are certain members of the military that will be doing the pass and review. And then from there, I believe they will be heading over to the Arlington Cemetery to lay a wreath in honor at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And so all that is happening now between about 11 and 1 or 2 o'clock today.
And just as we wrap up here, Dominique, help us understand what the last few weeks have meant for D.C. The inauguration is a time when the district is usually just bustling with so much energy and excitement and activity. But just a few weeks ago, there was an attack on the Capitol. What kind of lingering effects do you think we'll see in the district?
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people about this. A lot of people saying, you know, They wonder if increased security will be something that, DC will take now and start to implement more. It kind of feels, DC has been through somewhat of a terrorist. I mean, DC went through a terrorist attack 2 weeks ago to the day. And there are a lot of people who are, very concerned about that. And there are some people that, they say, I just want to get back to normal. I want to be able to, walk down my street and walk around downtown like normal. I mean, again, we're still in a pandemic. So there's this feeling that there's a lot of tension in the air. And they are hopeful, though. There's people who are hopeful that the new Biden administration will bring a little bit more calm to D.C. and to, the region. And I think that people are just really hopeful today and, trying to celebrate as well, too, a little bit.
That's Dominique Maria Benassi. She's a reporter at WAMU, our parent station. Dominique, thanks for being here with us to tell us what's happening.
Thank you so much, Jen.
Coming up, as the country prepares to look forward, we'll look back at past inaugurations and talk more about all the ways in which this inauguration is a whole other ballgame. And we'll hear from you on this special day. What one word best sums up how you're feeling right now? I'm Jen White. You can tweet us at 1A, drop a message on our Facebook page, or email us at 1A@WAMU.org. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. This is an inauguration day unlike any other. There are 25,000 National Guard troops lining the streets of D.C. The city has been locked down in the days leading up to inauguration. There's also a lot of lingering tension and fear of additional violence after the attack on the Capitol earlier this month. Let's talk about how unprecedented this inauguration is and look back on some other tense inaugurations with two historians. Nicole Hemmer is an associate research scholar with the Obama Presidency Oral History Project. She's also the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. Nikki, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us, Kelly Carter Jackson. She's a professor at Wellesley College. She's also the author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Kelly, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me too.
And they're co-hosts of the podcast, This Day in Esoteric Political History. We also want to hear from you. Are you watching today's inauguration? And how do you feel about it? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Nikki, this may be a bit obvious, but how is this inauguration different than any we've had before?
So it's different in a lot of ways. I mean, one big way is that on the inauguration platform is going to be the first Black woman who is going to be sworn in as Vice President of the United States. But it is also different for some darker reasons. Of course, the crowd size will be quite small because of the pandemic, and the Capitol will be ringed by tens of thousands of National Guard troops because of the fear of another attack. And that sort of end to the tradition of a peaceful transfer of power, which really did end on January 6th because of the insurrection at the Capitol, is a signal moment in the history of presidential transitions and presidential inaugurations. And the presence of so many troops and so much security really does drive that point home in a very visual and visceral way.
What do you think it signals?
You know, I think it signals something about the fragility of our democracy at this moment. I mean, the only other time that there has been this kind of tension and really violence around an inauguration was in 1861 with the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln. Just a little over a month later, the nation would dissolve into civil war. And while I don't think that this augurs that, the level of civil unrest that we've seen, the number of Americans who don't see Joe Biden as the legitimate president, I think does not signal happy days ahead when it comes to the health of American democracy.
We got this email from Teresa who says, I am feeling nervous. I'm so happy and excited for an administration that does not treat our Constitution like toilet paper, but I am really nervous something violent will happen in D.C. and on our state capitals today. Kelly, as you think about this day from a historical perspective, what are the outstanding differences you see and think about?
You know, I have mixed feelings today. In a lot of ways, I'm looking at my social media feeds and I'm really happy because I'm a Howard University alum. And so to see all of my fellow alumni, you know, going crazy with their Howard paraphernalia, or to see how the AKAs are going crazy with their pink and green, has been really inspiring and fun to see. On the other side, I do think that what we are seeing is, visually is quite stunning, in that there will be a larger security force than there will be citizens in attendance. And we've never had anything like that before. And I think it does cause a lot of people to, you know, be a little afraid. I've had friends close to me that say they're keeping their children home from school today because they're worried about violence that may occur. There are 50 protests in all 50 capitals planned today across the country. And so there's a lot of fear about what might happen, not just in the nation's capital, but at capitals all across the country.
Well, when we do a quick tally of how people are feeling today, we see as many people saying they're feeling anxious as there are people saying they feel relieved. You know, a big part of today's events is Joe Biden's inauguration speech. And I want to listen to a snippet of one of the most famous inauguration speeches in history, John F. Kennedy's.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
Kelly, give us some context here. What was going on in the lead up to this speech? What is JFK alluding to?
I mean, JFK is alluding to the Cold War, basically, and the idea that, you know, their violence could be at any turn, and that it's so important for the country to be united in the way that it sees itself going forward. And it's so important to talk about the importance of democracy. I think that's also an important point, because when we think about today, you know, we are reminded that democracy is so fragile, and that it is held together by our shared collective ideas, and that it doesn't take much for that idea to be threatened or even overturned.
Well, and Kennedy talks about paying any price to assure the survival of liberty. And President-elect Biden is also arguably grappling with a major blow to liberty, as we said, from within our own country. What lessons do you think he can learn from past presidents about defending democracy?
I think that's a really good question. I think we've been defending democracy from the moment this country was founded. And I think part of that is because this country was founded on this duplicitous idea of slavery and freedom simultaneously. And so we're constantly trying to get America to live up to its ideals and its principles of liberty and equality for all. And I feel like this is not just a struggle for Biden, but it's been a struggle for every single president who is trying to live up to these ideas. And so I think he has a big task in front of him. I think the best president that would serve as an example for him might be Abraham Lincoln, who was also, you know, facing a war and coming off tumultuous times and using his second inaugural address to bring healing to the country. I think that in some ways, Biden will have to do the same thing.
We can't ignore that this is happening again against the backdrop of a global pandemic. We got this tweet from Adam. He says, if Trump had been reelected, today would have been an opulent, tone-deaf, super-spreader event, the size of which would have been exaggerated while its medical risk was downplayed. You know, Nikki, it can be easy to forget that this was going to be a remote inauguration even before the assault on the Capitol. And what's interesting about the convergence of these events is that the pandemic really unveiled, I wouldn't even say unveiled, but it sort of brought heightened awareness to some of the deep inequities that exist in this country already. How do you think the inauguration can serve as perhaps a touch point for President-elect Biden to address some of those issues?
So I think that Joe Biden is very likely to acknowledge the deep challenges that face the United States. Of course, there are these kind of existential but immediate challenges of the pandemic and the sort of crumbling infrastructure of democracy in the United States. But these deep inequalities obviously predate the Trump administration. They've grown worse under the pandemic. But in many of his speeches leading up to this moment, and I suspect what we'll hear in his inauguration speech today, Joe Biden has acknowledged those sort of structural inequalities and does seem focused on doing something about them. And so he's basically going to have to do something that someone like Franklin Roosevelt had to do in 1933, which is not just gloss over or glide over the challenges that are facing the United States, but to acknowledge them and to say, look, we're facing a bit of a mountain here, but then pivoting to something more in that John F. Kennedy register of, but we can do this as a country, that there's hope and there's optimism that is rooted in the hard work that we as a nation are capable of doing if we start with these very fundamentals about democracy and equality.
Well, Linda emails, I'm so joyful that Trump is gone. I am sick of the lies, the racism, and the fragile masculinity. We have much to do, but I have great hope in what we can accomplish. And Kay emails, today feels to me like the end of a long nightmare. I feel a lot of hope, trepidation, and I'm sorry that our nation's capital, the beautiful city I lived in for many years, looks like a war zone. Let's listen to a bit of another past inauguration. Here's part of a speech Barack Obama delivered back in 2009.
In reaffirming the greatness of our nation, we understand that greatness is never a given. It must be earned. Our journey has never been one of shortcuts or settling for less. It has not been the path for the faint-hearted, for those who prefer leisure over work or seek only the pleasures of riches and fame. Rather, it has been the risk-takers.
Now, it's interesting that he brings up history belonging to the risk taker, since ultimately a criticism leveled against his presidency by progressives is that he didn't go far enough on some of his big swing agenda items. What do you think Biden will face in addressing, you know, some of these big issues that he wants to take on, but maybe trying to, I don't know, thread a needle there? Kelly?
Yeah, you know, Biden definitely has a mandate from Black and Brown communities, but the Black community in particular, I think there are high levels of expectations as to how he will address some of the harm that has been done during the Trump administration. And so, you know, I hear a lot of my friends and colleagues talk about student loans and student debt relief. And, you know, I heard Biden mention, you know, $50,000 in student loan debt and that some of that being erased. And for a lot of the Black community, that's not enough. It's not nearly enough. And so altering the racial wealth gap will take bold, audacious steps that I think a lot of people would be uncomfortable with. You know, we can see how hard it has been to get stimulus checks to people above $600. So when you think of student loan debt relief, those numbers have to be high in order to rectify the amount of economic hardships that people are facing. I think when we think of the prison industrial complex, mass incarceration, police reform, a lot of these gestures have to go much further than, you know, body cams or some of the other conversations that have happened. I think, you know, we've moved to a space that's beyond reform and into sort of abolition. And I'm not sure how many people are ready for these radical steps, but I think that's what a lot of people are demanding in order to see real systemic and structural change.
We're talking to Kelly Carter-Jackson and Nikki Hemmer. They're co-hosts of the podcast This Day in Esoteric Political History. The Obama administration is also where we started to see a Congress dug in and more divided by partisanship. This is also when the Tea Party began to emerge. How do those divisions connect and arguably lead to where we are right now, Kelly?
Oh, man. You know, from the moment that Barack Obama was elected, until now, we have seen an intense racial backlash. And I think that we've always seen this throughout history, that whenever you have political progress, particularly racial political progress, you can expect backlash. You can expect white supremacy numbers to grow and to be charged by that progress. Even if that progress is not substantial, but it's more symbolic, there is still pushback to that. And so Biden is going to be facing this as well. And at even heightened levels, I think, than Obama has faced during his presidency. I think that we have to be honest about the fact that we have a long, deep history of white supremacy in this country, and that these divisions and tensions and backlashes continue to present themselves, particularly when there is no reckoning or remedy to some of the harm that we have seen happen.
Well, speaking of where we are now, let's hear some of Donald Trump's inauguration speech in 2017.
Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities, rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation, an education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge. And the crime, and the gangs, and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
This speech later became famous, or to some infamous, and it's a very different tone than Obama's and JFK's. Nikki, what did this address indicate about the tenor of Trump's time in office?
Well, it did indicate that he was going to continue to be combative and that he was going to continue to operate in this dark and divisive register that did define his presidency. What's interesting about that moment is if you just read it on the page, you sort of hear a president saying, look, we've been through bad times and I'm going to move us out of those bad times. He was describing America as it was, as American carnage, and then promising to bring the United States out of that. But of course, what we saw almost immediately was a dark turn in American politics, from the Muslim travel ban, which was put in place almost immediately, the rise, as Kelly was talking about, of violent right-wing extremism and white power extremism in the United States. And of course, as we sit here today, the phrase American carnage could not be a more apt descriptor for the state we find ourselves in, with 400,000 Americans having died in less than a year because of the pandemic. The economy is in worse shape. The economy is less equitable. It wasn't that great in terms of equality at the beginning of the Trump administration. It's less equitable now, particularly with women of color being driven out of the economy due to the downturn. And so it's one of those things where American carnage was meant to be a descriptor, but it actually turned out to be a prediction that came true.
We're discussing the history of tense inaugurations with Nikki Hemmer, an associate research scholar with the Obama Presidency Oral History Project. She's also the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. Also with us, Kelly Carter Jackson, a professor at Wellesley College. She's also the author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. They're co-hosts of the podcast This Day in Esoteric Political History. We're also hearing from you. Graves tweets, I am honest. Honestly, realizing I've been holding my breath for the last 4 years. I'm an immigration attorney, and we were in the courthouse 4 years ago getting an injunction against the Muslim ban, and now here we are. William on Facebook says, this inauguration will be the worst in history. There will be more people protesting than celebrating. They called out the National Guard to protect the process. That should be a big indicator that the next 4 years are going to be bad. And Aiden emails, while the recent violence is very concerning, I have confidence that there is a silent majority of level-headed Americans who know that even if they don't like Biden and are disappointed, they also know he didn't win via fraud. We're not hearing from those who didn't vote at all or those who voted for Trump for simple policy reasons, and not for the emotional collectivist reasons that most angry members of his base did. This is 1A. back to our conversation in a moment, but first, we'd love your help with tomorrow's show. In the first few days of his presidency, Joe Biden is planning to sign more than 15 executive orders. These cover issues like climate change, education, and health care. Tomorrow, we'll look into some of his early plans, and we want to know what you think his top priorities should be. What are you hoping to see from the first few days of the Biden presidency? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. The Biden administration has a lot of plans, but what is the first thing they should do? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A, or you can send us an audio file with our app, 1A Vox Pop, and we'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Now let's get back to our conversation with Nikki Hemmer, an associate research scholar with the Obama Presidency Oral History Project. She's also the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. Also with us, Kelly Carter, a 19th century historian and professor at Wellesley College. She's also the author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. They're co-hosts of the podcast This Day and Esoteric Political History. Nikki, President Trump not only isn't attending the president-elect's inauguration, he and Melania Trump flew to Florida this morning. How common is it for a president to skip out on his successor's inauguration?
It's pretty unusual. The last time that a president refused to go to the inauguration of his predecessor, of his successor, was in 1869, when Andrew Johnson refused to go to the inauguration of Ulysses S. Grant. And that refusal, which had only happened a few other times before, John Adams in 1801 refused to go to Thomas Jefferson's inauguration, and then John Quincy Adams refused to go to Andrew Jackson's. And it tends to signal that there are real tensions between the outgoing and the incoming president. And it also suggests not just that the inauguration looks a little different, but that the transition itself has been difficult. And that's certainly something that, you know, we saw in 1801, John Adams was trying to force through as many judges from his party as possible right into the very last minute. Andrew Johnson and Ulysses S. Grant did not communicate well during the transition period. And in fact, Grant thought that Johnson was going to the inauguration, that they were just taking separate carriages, but Johnson ended up skipping out on it altogether. And, you know, in this case, the transition hasn't involved a lot of communication between the Trump team and the Biden team. The traditional conversations that happen haven't happened. And so I think that this is symbolic of a deeper tension or a deeper divide between the two administrations.
Well, there's tension and then there's a complete breakdown. Have we seen the peaceful transfer of power break down completely before?
Not really like this. I mean, this really is the first time we have seen an outgoing president sort of lead the or lead to the destruction or the rejection of a peaceful transfer of power. You know, I mentioned 1861 earlier, and that was not a peaceful transfer of power because you had states that were leaving the Union and seceding in the buildup to the Civil War, but that wasn't led by the outgoing president. And in this case, having a president both refuse to acknowledge that Joe Biden won the election and then the role that he's now been impeached for inciting the insurrection at the Capitol, which was actual physical violence meant to stop the peaceful transfer of power. I mean, this is something that is, I think it's fair to say, unique in U.S. history and something that we are going to have to contend with in the months and years ahead.
I want to read two messages we received. This one's from Leslie, who says, 12 years ago, I had the honor to watch President Obama's inauguration with 100 young students at the school where I was working. We were all transfixed. Today, now retired, I am transfixed again. I am cautiously optimistic about America's future. I definitely hope the ceremony is peaceful and uninterrupted and that all state capitals stay calm. We also got this email from Christopher, who says, all Democrats are traitors. I don't care how much you lie. I will never accept Biden as a legitimate president. He's only there due to the Democrats destroying the Constitution. The only unity Democrats will accept is total submission to their radical ideology. When you hear those two messages, one after another, Nikki, what does it say to you about where we are as a country right now?
Well, I think it reflects a deep fracture in the United States. And unlike polarization that is based around policy or different ideologies, these really are divisions based on entirely different, not just worldviews, but understandings of facts, right? There is a conspiracy theory about election fraud that has taken hold with a significant portion of the population. And when you don't even have a common base of facts, a basic connection to reality that you're arguing over, that creates a division that's very, very difficult to bridge. And you can also hear a kind of frustration an unwillingness to, give Joe Biden a chance as president. And I think that that speaks to something important going forward, which is, of course, we're all very concerned about making sure that we get through today as safely as possible, that there is no violence today. But the divisions, the far-right violence that we've seen throughout the past decade, that's not something that is going to go away. And so we face an uphill climb when it comes to these issues going forward. The inauguration is not going to heal this divide.
Well, and Kelly, when we think about this idea of healing the nation, we've been hearing that a lot. We've heard President-elect Biden talk a lot about unity and how he'll be a president for all people. But when I read a message like Christopher's, I see someone who isn't interested in listening to messages about unity. And, you know, the most flowery speech, the most eloquent speech on Inauguration Day, I don't think is going to fix that. Are there other points in history we can look to for lessons about what can come next?
Oh, man. Yeah, I agree. There's no speech in the world that is going to sort of solve these problems, particularly because we cannot get consensus around the truth. And that has been one of the greatest stumbling blocks. And in order to do that, you know, it requires trust. You have to believe what someone is saying. And because a certain subset of America has been inundated with these conspiracy theories and with these, you know, outright lies, it's incredibly hard to combat that. Particularly if you're unwilling to believe or unwilling to trust.
Kelly, we're having a little bit of trouble with your line, so we're going to reconnect and come back to you, but please hold that thought. In the meantime, let's hear one more inauguration speech. This is Ronald Reagan back in 1981.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. From time to time, we've been tempted to believe that society has become too complex to be managed by self-rule, that government by an elite group is superior to government for, by, and of the people. Well, if no one among us is capable of governing himself, then who among us has the capacity to govern someone else?
Nikki, you specialize in conservative media. Listening to that clip from Reagan and thinking about the GOP today, how much difference do you see between the GOP of Reagan's age and the GOP of now?
You know, there are some differences and there are also some continuities. I mean, the sort of populist message that is embedded in that anti-government rhetoric from Reagan is actually something you heard from Trump as well in his inaugural address, that he was going to take power from the government and give it to the people. So that is a through line. There is, at the same time, you know, Donald Trump, at least rhetorically, said that he wanted to keep Social Security, keep Medicare, use government in order to help the people he was interested in helping, generally his supporters. And so that kind of, you know, during the Reagan era, we thought of conservatism as ideological, as about a certain set of principles and a certain set of precepts. Under Donald Trump, conservatism has been less attached to those principles. I mean, under the Trump presidency, government spending has obviously exploded. It did under the Reagan presidency as well. But also, You know, Donald Trump has never put himself out there as a movement conservative. And what we have seen is that rather than demanding that a set of conservative principles be adhered to by the Trump administration, we saw the conservative base of the Republican Party substitute for those principles simply loyalty to Donald Trump. If Donald Trump was promoting it, then by and large, the conservative base was on board. Not necessarily conservative intellectuals, but the conservative base. And so there has been a real transition from the idea that conservatism represented a set of principles to it now representing a set of loyalties.
So to reference back to that message we received from Christopher, and as someone who studies conservative media, how striking is it to you that this inauguration is being read by some is not just unearned, but altogether illegitimate?
It's going to be a huge problem going forward. I mean, this isn't the first time that we've seen this. Of course, the spread of the birtherism conspiracy theory during the Obama administration was about doing the same work, saying that his presidency was illegitimate. But even in sort of the moves that we've seen from Fox News in the past week, as they've doubled down on opinion and doubled down on the Trump-supporting voices at the network, we're unlikely to see a shift toward a shift away from the kinds of conspiracies that we've heard over the past 4 or 5 years. And that's why I worry about what this divide is going to look like going forward, because I don't think that they're going to get on board with the legitimacy of the Biden administration and how that then translates into these kinds of conspiracies that will percolate over the next 4 years at least is something that's pretty worrisome when we think about democracy as being founded on the consent of the governed and having to have faith in these kinds of processes of democracy.
We're talking to Nikki Hemmer and Kelly Carter Jackson. They're co-hosts of the podcast This Day in Esoteric Political History. And Kelly, I know we have you back now, and I want you to pick up on your thoughts about the messages of unity we've been hearing from President-elect Biden heading into the inauguration, and how that plays out against what is a deeply divided nation right now, where part of the nation doesn't see his presidency as legitimate.
Yeah, it's really troubling, to say the least. I think that Biden is going to have to do a lot of work, not just rhetorically, but also through policy, to show how invested he is in the lives of all Americans. I think until he can get in office and actually institute, you know, real substantial change, most people are not going to be willing to believe the things that he says. I even think that to some extent, Black Americans are also somewhat skeptic, you know, of being used by the Democratic Party, but then also feeling like when those people are in power, that they will not always work for their benefit. So I think everyone's going to be watching to see how Joe Biden's rhetoric plays out into policy and plays out into, you know, real structural legislation that will benefit and change the lives of those who most need that change.
Well, we already have an idea of what President-elect Biden's tone will be during his inaugural address. Here he is yesterday giving a speech in Delaware.
As I told Bo on that station waiting for Barack and Hunter, I said, don't tell me things can't change. They can, and they do. That's America. That's Delaware, a place of hope and light and limitless possibilities.
Nikki, what message do you think President-elect Biden will try to send in his speech today?
Oh, I think it will be a message very much rooted in hope and healing. We know that Joe Biden's story is one of tremendous tragedy and overcoming that tragedy. And when he speaks, he's very deeply connected to a kind of emotional core that's grounded in, you know, helping other people. That's kind of who Joe Biden is. And so even though I think that there are many Democrats who wish he would come out swinging in his inaugural address, I do think that it is his character to come out with a message of unity and healing. Remember that his campaign started with reference to the white power violence in Charlottesville in 2017, and his sense that signaled that there was something deeply wrong with America, and that it needed a unity and healing, but a unity and healing that was based on equality and justice. And I think that's going to be both the message and the emotion that we hear today.
Kelly, I'm curious how you think this day will be remembered by historians, because I think about what it's like to piece together history when people are living in so many different versions of what they believe is true.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to consider when we look back at this day. First and foremost, we'll have to consider the pandemic, which has drastically altered the attendance of the inauguration. But also, I think we'll have to look at the security and the safety of the inauguration itself to make sure that violence does not break out. But I also think that it will be filled with, you know, hope and optimism, that we'll look back on the optics of Vice President Kamala Harris being, you know, sworn in by Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and how momentous that occasion is. I think that there are moments that we can look back at this inauguration and see aspects of pride and hope and joy, but also realize that this was, you know, colored by a somber occasion, and an occasion that will make us think about where our country is headed and where we have yet to go.
That's Kelly Carter Jackson. She's a 19th century historian and professor at Wellesley College. She's also the author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Also with us, Nicole Hemmer, an associate research scholar with the Obama Presidency Oral History Project. She's also the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. They co-host the podcast This Day in Esoteric Political History. Kelly, Nicole, thanks for your time. Remember to subscribe to the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and stories every day, and you can listen whenever you'd like. Get it wherever you find your podcasts. Today's producer was Katie Klein. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.